Talk given Friday, 14th November, 1975. All over the world, we see how violence is on the increase. And this violence is accompanied by an obvious loss of moral backbone. Up till the last war, certainly, practically all countries had certain standards of conduct in the political world, the business world, social standards, and they had some considerable respect for the law. They also had a respect for individual human beings. They had some sort of sense of how man should behave towards man in any social order. Today, we see all that crumbling down. Why? How? It is easy to point to certain external circumstances. Quarter of a century ago, when the idea of the welfare state and the affluent state was being fostered, people thought that life would be happy, would be more decent, would be secure, and there'd be progress in a truly human sense of the term progress. On the contrary, quite the reverse is taking place. We all know how crime is on the increase, absolutely, not just preserving the same proportion according to the population to what it was, say, in pre-war days. It is definitely on the increase. Morality seems to have vanished altogether. It has almost become a dirty word for the masses. There is no such thing as respect for human beings or human values, excepting in a steadily diminishing degree amongst the few who do have a vision of what it means to be a human being and how one should live humanly. And it is quite recognized in practically all quarters by those who are honest enough to speak the truth of what they see, that affluence makes it easier for the degeneration of character and for the downfall of any social order, of any state. Deprivation, we know, has its drawbacks where real deprivation is concerned. But on the whole, it might be true to say that the evils of affluence outweigh the evils of deprivation. Because if character goes, if morality goes, if respect for the good things that have been achieved and are worthwhile maintaining, if all that goes, then we are descending into savagery. Affluence we can point to as one of the external causes. But surely, some of the most humanitarian activities in the world have often been initiated by people who are rich, by countries and states which had the means, the wherewithal to start such activities and maintain them for the benefit of humanity. So, other than affluence as an outward cause, we must look for inner causes. And where shall we look for them except within ourselves? After all, it is not things, objects, it is not affluence as affluence which lets loose senseless, cowardly murder, to take one simple example of it. It takes a living human being to commit an act of murder. It takes a living human being to express in his actions a total disregard of human values. So it is the living human being we must look to. We hold up our hands in horror at the violence which goes on all over the world. And we say, oh, look at that, look at that, look at that. But what is that a manifestation of? Is it not an expression of violence within ourselves? Is it not also associated with a non-recognition of the fact that we can never make another person non-violent? We can make ourselves non-violent. Because if violence is in my nature, there is the root for the spread of violence. It's the same with morality of any standards of anything that is worthwhile and good in life. It starts from within oneself. As long as I am capable of reacting with anger, with hate, with lust, when any stimulus comes to me, however provocative it may be, then I am the source of that violence. We may say, but I never have hurt anybody, I have never murdered anybody, or wounded anybody, etc., etc. Perfectly true, I haven't done it. But what about my mind and heart? If I am utterly free in my mind of all reactions of hate, of enmity, then I am no longer charging the psychical atmosphere with the force of violence, of hate, of enmity. These psychical influences are a tremendous reality. We all know from our own living experience, when we go, say, into a gathering of people somewhere, we catch the atmosphere. We are aware of the atmosphere. Now, what is that atmosphere due to? But to the psychical influence of all those present. If you have a group of lecherous minded people in a hall or a room or wherever it may be, one will soon experience that peculiar discomfort, that peculiar antipathy, because of that atmosphere. If one is oneself inclined to lechery, oh, then you are in harmony with that atmosphere and you fall into lechery quite easily. If the atmosphere is one of serious-minded concern with the worthwhile things in life, then you sense that, and it increases, it fosters what is worthwhile in ourselves, and we contribute to it. Now, we cannot alter the other person, excepting by the spontaneous, natural influence of one's own psychical state, which the other person cannot escape. If I am in a state of depression and misery, I infect my neighbor with it. So I can't avoid doing that. But if I am not in a depressed state, if I am calm, serene, clear-sighted, and so forth, then I also infect my neighbor. I'm using the word infect deliberately, with something which is the very reverse of depression or misery. Now, this is something which we have to get hold of. We are too concerned with the institution, with organization as we call it, but which is far more of the nature of mechanization than of organization. Mechanization meaning something just put together. Artificially put together. Organization is a living thing. Organizing is a living integrating. It's an integrating, not just a adding things together. Now, in order to bring about such integration, we must first of all see that we mustn't look to external things, to plans, to systems, to methods which are thought out by people to bring about a right state of affairs. You all know the statement, thought never added a cubit to man's spiritual stature. The thought out cannot do it. But we are all caught in this trap of a belief and a trust in external organization. Now, one may ask, why does not external organization bring about a desirable state of affairs? What is wrong with planning by intelligent people, by people with skill, with knowledge of what they are dealing with, and so forth? Let us look a little deeply into this. Whenever anybody plans anything, in relation to what or whom as a center does he plan? He plans something for good, as he calls it, quite sincerely and honestly, plans for good in relation to himself all the time. If he's planning, if he says, oh no, it's not for myself, it's for my family, my society, my nation, all the rest of it. This is also self-centered, because he is identifying himself with the family, with society, with the nation, and so forth. If it is not to the interests of the nation, then he will not plan that way. So that he's planning for himself. If he can plan for the good of the nation, completely dissociating himself, then what he plans for the nation's good might do him a great deal of harm. It might be to his detriment. Now, if he's capable of being unself-concerned to that extent, then possibly his plan may have value for the nation. But this is never the case. There is always this self-association. And therefore, whatsoever is planned out is always self-centered. You have heard me say this again and again. Intellect is the slave of desire. And all desire is a self-oriented thing. It's energy which is expended for the satisfaction of the self. That's desire. So intellect is the slave of desire. Naturally, one will ask then, what is the way out? Surely, have we not had great men of vision throughout history in the past? Yes, we have. But who are these men of vision? The men who had grown into pure humanity, which means that they were unselfed, utterly unselfed. How do we recognize, what do we understand by this unselfed person, this two-legged creature called man, who is a true human? Now consider all the other creatures on the globe, living creatures. How does their life function? It functions in terms of drawing the world unto each one of them in order that the individual may survive, self-preservation in other words, and in order that the species may continue to exist. But whichever way you look at it, it is always a drawing to oneself. The human species does precisely that, like the animal does, draws to it, to itself. All human beings do that. Now, that is necessary in order that the individual shall continue to exist. But with the human species, there is another factor involved. The human body has grown in such a way, the structure, the living structure, has changed in a way which is complementary to the functioning of the human being. I don't mean just his biological function. I'm referring to his functioning as a creature in whom mind and consciousness play the dominant role. In our human sense of the term, mind. The animal has no conception of what mind is. Our brain has outrun in development certain aspects of the mind which still remain in their infantile stage. And the aspect of mind and consciousness which is least developed in man is his awareness of himself, the particular individual, as integral part and parcel of all mankind. This must not be misunderstood as a herd sense. Man has to be fully self-aware as the complete microcosmic individual, like an animal is aware of itself, and much more intensely man is aware of himself. And also man has to be aware of himself in the macrocosmic sense of an integral part and parcel of all mankind. Now, in order that this awareness may flourish, certain other aspects come into being. The pure animal reacts to stimuli. He has no ethical sense like a human being can have. The animal's morality is just spontaneous and natural, not due to an awareness from within himself that this is the right way to behave. When the mother tiger jumps at me and eats me up because I dare to approach her cubs, she does it quite naturally and spontaneously, perfectly right. So I don't mean that merely, but this awareness from within oneself of relationship of my withinness to the total withoutness, the outsideness, and that is the whole individual in the macrocosmic sense. Now that involves first and foremost, fundamentally, and always involves, as long as mankind will be on the globe, a transcendent ethic. Which means that the values, the virtues, love, truthfulness, goodness, and so on, all of them are not cultivated as acquisitions for oneself, but are allowed to emerge because one is conscious, one is aware in terms of wholeness. This is totally different. Your cultivated virtue, however good it may be, however effective it may be within certain limited contexts, falls down when the context has changed in such a manner that the provocation for the opposite of that virtue triumphs over the virtue. Some of you have lived through the last war. Some of us have lived through two wars. And one of the things which was very noticeable was this sort of situation. Fine people, people with large hearts, tolerant, educated, with a passion for including other nations and so forth. When war broke out, you should have seen how that veneer of culture, that veneer of acquired virtue, fell down to the ground. Rubbed off very easily. So you see, one has to understand how is it that people who, not unjustifiably, were considered such fine people should behave in such a disappointing way. And if you could look deeply enough, you would see that this acquired virtue, this acquired culture, was like so much finery or or the dress which was worn by a person who was at root self-oriented, self-centered. He did not have a true awareness, a living consciousness of mankind. The thought and the accompanying word that we are all brothers, or all mankind is one, man is just one species, and so forth. Yes, superficial intellectual acceptance, impotent to produce the right action when the provocation became sufficiently great. And this lies at the heart of religious growth. Religion means a restoration to the whole, an integration into the whole, part of this living whole. I am but one cell in the body of mankind. I cannot live and act in terms of a reciprocal arrangement, a business contract with my neighboring cell, and tell him, now then, brother cell, provided you will carry out all your duties as a self-motivated, self-healing, self-reproducing cell in a decent way, I will do so accordingly. If you don't, I'll smack you. You see, we can't do it that way. This acquired virtue, this acquired idealism and so forth, this slavery of intellect to desire, is all mechanical. It's dead. It has no living power in it. But it is the real awareness, this living awareness of wholeness, which is the spiritual, mysterious, inner dynamic power which changes our action. Its manifestation is first within our own psyche. We no longer react in terms of hate, of lust, of illusions and delusions, of greed, and so forth. So you will see the tremendous importance of so living, of being so watchful, so alert all the time, so awake, that we always see quite clearly the truth of our psychical state as it comes into being. There are strong forces which are against us in this effort. The natural tendency of all the 15 billion cells of the organism are for self-preservation and the continuity of the species. The physical cells are like that. That will never change. But insofar as the brain, will work in such a way that it will see the fact of our integration into the totality. It will see that so intensely that a totally different mode of life emerges out of us. No longer seeking for self all the time, both consciously and unconsciously, but seeking for self just for maintenance and all the time flowing outwards to the totality. You can't flow outwards because the intellect says, this is the logical, the truthful, the good, and the right thing to do. Do it. Can't do it that way. Intellect, the thought process, won't do it. You can't force yourself to feel this, that, or the other. You can't order yourself to love John Smith. You just love him, or you dislike him. This is something you cannot order. People don't somehow see this. And of course, when one hears that, one says, but then we are in a hopeless position. Heads I win, tails you lose. Wait a minute. Yes, that's it. Heads I win, tails you lose. Which means only a one-way street again. One-way movement. And that movement is always self-oriented. Now this is something which towards which we must bend all our energies. And it's very difficult. Because as I said, these 15 billion cells, which are the very basis of our existence, are animal cells. And they fulfill the law of the animal. It is our personal responsibility to see and open out to the other. And in the seeing and opening out, not conflict with the animal, but so understand and love the animal that the animal becomes tamed and trained in the right way. Not compelled to conform to a preconceived picture of virtue and rightness, but to be so aware of the unity that the whole psychophysical organism will inevitably live virtuously. Free of all reaction of lust and greed and hate and avarice, free of ambition, envy, jealousy, and all those things. Now, if we can see life that way, we will not waste our energies in trying to plan out ways and means of bringing about a desirable result in the midst of this chaos. Such planning is a case of not accepting our personal responsibility. It is relying upon that which is not vital not alive, not creative. We have to be the truth. We have to be love, be wisdom itself. And if one's attention is intensely directed towards the meaning and significance of that, then we are doing the best that can be done humanly by us as individuals. Then somewhere, somehow, generally speaking, here now itself, there is a change taking place. When the change takes place in our own living nature, and inevitably, spontaneously and naturally influences others also, for their mental and spiritual health, then the violence and the evil of the world will change and give place to something which is good in the enduring sense of the good. You know how in the teaching of the Kabbalah, one of the great characteristics of Yahweh is lasting endurance. That which endures. Free of the domination of time. And if it is free of the domination of time, it means that it is free of the domination of sorrow and sin and death. This lasting endurance of the transcendent. And thereby, the transcendent is the source from which comes all good. So we have to somehow get into harmony with that. Don't think of it and say, I've got to get in harmony with that thought. Just get the feel of this life, pure life, which you and I don't know. See, this is one of the deep meanings of faith. That which you sense, just naturally and spontaneously sense as the ultimately real, trust in that. Don't seek to know it in specific terms. Because all knowledge in specific terms is turned for self purposes. Because we think we are doing this. I do nothing. I can't do anything. Transcendence is the doer. You find this in the Gita too. Sri Krishna points to one of the illusions which people, men suffer from. They think they are the doers, forgetting that he, incarnate God, is the real doer. You know how Jesus answers those in authority. You are able to do this, that and the other by virtue of the power given you by God. You couldn't do it on your own. But we suffer from this illusion that we are the doers, that we do this, that and the other. And all planning in the ordinary way throughout the countries of the world by all the controlling authorities and bodies in the world is in terms of self-centeredness. This wonderful delusion that they can do this, that and the other. They can't. If they are prepared to be blind, as self-centered people, then the light of the transcendent will give them pure vision. If they are prepared to be deaf, in terms of listening to their own desires and trying to fulfill them, they will hear the song of life of transcendence itself, and they will sing and dance in harmony with it quite naturally, not knowing how to sing and dance. And that is how it is in reality. Nature displays this quite spontaneously. But we don't learn. Those of us who do see it in nature wonder, why is it that we can't be like that? And the secret is just this. I can't be like that because I am still self-oriented in my inner consciousness. But when I can free myself from this prison house of self-orientedness, my mind and consciousness begins to function in terms of mankind, even more in terms of the totality. And then that totality, which I'd like to name transcendence, comes to fruition through me, the individual. And this is the real power that can change the world. Nothing else. All the rest is futility. People will say, but here is the actual situation. You've got to do something about it. Yes, indeed. Do something about it. Do the best you can, but be alert inwardly. Is this the truth? If you see that this is the truth, well, your action will be thus. If you see this is anger, this is hate, this is kindness, this is generosity, if you really see that, your action will be according to it. Be awake, be alert. This is the whole thing. Why did the Buddha teach samasati, perfect mindfulness? Why did Jesus say, watch? If he were to say, watch, when bombs are exploding in the West End, people will say, get along and do something, what are you watching? He didn't mean watch in that sense. But if you watch, when you see the explosion, death and destruction spread around you, if you can see it with your whole being, that watching will express itself in physical action which the immediate situation demands. And you can't do any different from that. It's as simple as this. You can lift 300 weight perhaps in order to release a man who is trapped under some broken masonry or whatever it is. But you can't lift 3 tons. An elephant can do that. You do what you can, the elephant will do what he can. And we have to, that is where good sense, practicality comes in. We have to do what we can. But whilst the elephant will do it because he's trained to do it like that, we have to do it with an awareness, a complete awareness of the true nature of things as they happen around us. This, as far as I can see, means religiousness in action.